I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. In the city where I live, the fire department recently sponsored a big project. It was focused on plants, of all things. Now, on the face of things, why would the fire department be so concerned about, say, the plants that are growing around my house? It does make sense, because I live near a boundary which is described as the wildland-urban interface. That's where the city butts up against the wild. And where you have wild, sometimes you have wildfires. And where you have cities, sometimes you have the wrong plants around the houses that are flammable or inflammable, depending on your usage. So what's to be done? Well, the fire department in my neighborhood encouraged us to chop down a few things. We are going to look at the flip side of this issue with somebody who can talk about not what to chop down, but what to plant, and specifically the planting of bananas in the cause of fighting wildfires. Dr. Bharath Raghavan is an assistant professor of computer science at the University of Southern California, where he co-leads the university's networked systems lab. Raghavan's projects frequently span multiple areas of computer science and other disciplines, including sustainability. It's a delight to have him with us now. Bharath Raghavan, thank you for joining with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
You know, the problem is already so well known about wildfires in the West, but just briefly, could you maybe recap your thoughts about where we stand with California wildfires and just the situation, how we really ought to be thinking innovatively about this?
Yeah, so we've known, and historically California and the West has had, you know, a relationship with fire for thousands of years. And, you know, we've known that that's how the plants here are sort of evolved. They're evolved to cope with fire and even sometimes thrive with, you know, periodic fires. The challenge really comes from the urban expansion that we've had over the last century, where we've built homes increasingly not just in the flatlands, but towards the hills, where typically that's where the fire risk is. And that has been connected to the other challenge, which is as the climate keeps warming, we just have not necessarily greater drought in California. That's still not totally clear, the signal on that. But we have had extreme weather. We've had more extreme droughts and more extreme wetness. And those don't necessarily coincide. The other problem is that the temperature is warming, which means that things dry out faster. And so you have a confluence of problems. You have potentially so longer fire seasons, you have higher temperatures, which means more drying, and you have homes that are now closer to those fire risk areas, the wildland urban interface, as it's called. And so now you have potentially in California, millions of homes that are at risk because of this wildfire danger. We've seen in the last several years in California that it's almost an annual event. It's basically evacuation season in the fall. In the fall, it happens to be when our greatest fire risk is, but increasingly the fire season is spanning year round these days. And that's, you know, taxing fire crews in terms of just the sheer workload that they have to, you know, to keep going with. But also you have this bigger problem that what do you do if your house is at risk of burning down and you have to be evacuated every year? We can't pick up and move millions of houses, and the hillsides are potentially quite large. So the cost of, for example, doing what, you know, the defensible space would involve potentially mowing vast areas of hillside that are right next to these urban areas. So how do we do that? And so the question really we were coming at it from is, can we do something that's a little better than this?
Yeah. Now, you come at this with a discipline of computer science. And so I'm going to take a stab at this. And I'm going to guess that you're very interested in some kind of computer modeling for what might happen with this, that, or the other approach to fighting wildfires.
Yeah, so computer science, it's really not the natural first place you would go in terms of discipline to connect to this kind of problem. Where it really comes from for me is that for a long time I've been a horticulture enthusiast, I guess you could say. So I've been part of California Rare Fruit Growers. I grow 150 plus species of fruits. I don't have very much space, so a lot of them are in containers. But, I've been growing and planting in public space a lot. And so I really like thinking about how do we use lots of different interesting crop species, really fruit species especially. And in this context, I thought, okay, well, you know, California happens to have a mild enough climate that we can grow a really wide range of species here. And so can we plant something that is both fireproof or fire resistant? And as a result of, you know, sort of being fruit based, potentially profitable, so it would actually have a fruit yield harvest. And so you get what's sometimes called a multifunctional landscape, something where you're going to get multiple benefits from it. In this case, fire prevention and some sort of crop yield and potentially some other, you know, ecosystem benefits such as erosion control. And so specifically, that's where I started thinking about bananas, since I happen to grow bananas and they grow quite well in most of the areas of California where the population is and where the fire risk is. So that's sort of where I began with this. And then the computer science comes in and actually doing the modeling. So, you know, that's what we've been looking into. How do we model the fire spread? What does that tell us about the effectiveness of such a banana fire buffer?
Well, not a lot of people have ever heard about bananas being used as fire buffers. And so this is really quite perplexing and exciting all at the same time and a little bit mystifying. Some of this has to do, though, with the property of the plant itself, the characteristics of banana. I'm going to call them trees. I understand they're not trees. But what is it about the banana as a species that would be so helpful here?
Well, bananas are mostly moisture, so they don't have any wood in them. Usually they're sort of – sometimes, yeah, we call them banana trees, but really they're – you could think of them as a large herb. So, you know, if you actually cut a banana stalk, there's no wood in there at all. And you'll find that when you cut a banana stalk, it's just dripping with moisture because the banana sap will flow, you know, for a long time after you cut it because it's so moist. As a result, you know, it's not particularly flammable. You know, if you go on YouTube, you'll find people cooking banana leaves over an open flame and it will wilt. But it takes quite a bit for it to dry out before then it actually burn. And so it's not that bananas won't burn, but compared to almost anything else that we could grow, it's going to be quite fire resistant, you know, similar to like a succulent, for example.
How long have you been growing bananas yourself?
When was the first one? I don't know, maybe 8 or 9 years, something like that.
And have you grown them to fruition where you get actual bananas off of them? Or are they just ornamental?
No, yeah, for sure, with fruit. So, you know, I fruited them in public space, actually. So in the Bay Area, Northern California, I fruited them on the street side. And they, you know, that's a much more commonplace thing in Southern California. People plant them all over the place and, you know, grow them in backyards and fruit them. So it's maybe not that common that people grow them, but it's widely known. And there used to be some commercial banana orchards in Southern California. The main downside, of course, is that they have high moisture content, but they also need quite a bit of water. And so there's sort of this funny connection here, which is that typically you would think, well, something that is needs a lot of water in a place that doesn't have a lot of water would be a bad idea. You know, how could we afford the water to do this? But it turns out that more and more of these new neighborhoods, the exact neighborhoods that we need to defend against wildfires, have recycled water irrigation. This is sort of a development that came out of Orange County starting about, I don't know, 4 decades ago, 5 decades ago, when they started putting in so-called purple pipes. And those purple pipes are recycled water pipes, so the municipal water gets processed, but only partially processed, so that it's physically safe, but it's not safe to drink. And so it's sanitized. And so then that water then gets used for irrigation. Right now, though, it's mostly being used to irrigate ornamentals in these neighborhoods. And what we're proposing to do is take that same recycled water that is in those neighborhoods for the reason that those neighborhoods were built recently, and then using that water to irrigate the bananas. So, you know, we're defending the neighborhoods with their own recycled water in some ways, the water that their own wastewater that they're producing.
Is a banana tree particularly adept at holding its water, at not becoming, you know, dried out? It doesn't desiccate with say, Santa Ana winds, for instance.
So the trunk will be just fine. The leaves will get battered in the Santa Ana winds. So you'll see they'll have this sort of frilly pattern. The leaves naturally will sort of split along the I guess we would call it sort of the horizontal axis, I guess you'd say, of the leaf. But the leaves are sort of naturally evolved to do that. So they do just fine. What I'd say is that the trees themselves will be just fine for quite a while. Even if, let's say, the irrigation system stops working for some reason, it'll do just fine. You actually see along, you know, the train tracks, for example, in sort of abandoned lots and industrial lots, some places in LA, you'll see bananas growing in the back of the lot, where I can't imagine they're getting a whole lot of care. And, you know, they don't look great. They don't look aesthetically amazing, but they're still growing and they still look fine. So, you know, they hold so much water that they can survive a dry season, sometimes ironically better than what we think of as drought tolerant trees like figs. You know, a fig tree is a drought tolerant tree, but you, and I don't know if you've run into this in Utah, but, you know, I've had plenty of fig trees where if it's truly in a parched location, the fig tree's leaves will just wilt and drop off.
Yeah. Well, the reason I ask this is because most people stereotypically will think about a banana as being sort of a tropical thing. We think it has to be in a place where there's great humidity. You know, you think of Hawaii, mm-hmm. for instance.
That's where it likes to be best. It's native to India and Southeast Asia. But it does just fine all over Southern California. People, you know, produce huge amounts of bananas in their backyards, as I do with, you know, some of my relatives around here planted in their yards, and they're getting, you know, good yields of really good bananas. And one of the nice things is that doing this, we can grow varieties that are not commercially available. And as a result of that, potentially the same fruit can get a higher share in the market.
So I'm thinking now about the Cavendish banana and the fact that we hear stories of that particular variety being susceptible to a fungus and it could go away from the markets. You're not worried about that because there's enough varieties out there.
Oh yeah, there's dozens and dozens of varieties. Some have been selected specifically for fungal tolerance. We could plant some of those. I mean, the real key is diversity. So that, you know, the standard solution to avoiding these kinds of fungal diseases is to not plant a monoculture. And so, you know, if we do these banana plantings, then we can plant a diversity of them. And some of them are going to do better in certain locations than others. Certain banana cultivars are more cold tolerant. Some, you know, fruit faster, some fruit slower, some are taller, some are shorter. So we can take advantage of that diversity in each microclimate.
Yeah, I was thinking about a famous gardener who's written a lot about permaculture, who lives someplace, I don't know, somewhere between Pennsylvania and Chicago, and he's grown successfully bananas in a climate like that. Mm. Just, I guess, in a microclimate close to the house enough that maybe it never fruits, but at least it survives. And mm-hmm. and that brings up the question of the range that you would envision for using a banana buffer in a place like California. Could you go up near mm-hmm. Mount Shasta, up near Paradise, for instance?
Yeah. So actually, it's good that you brought up Paradise, because one of the things that we've considered is, where is this not going to be applicable? Because I don't want it to come across that this is some magical solution that's going to work everywhere. So the scientists who work on wildland urban interface questions, the terminology that often gets used is that there's interface regions and then there's intermix regions. The interface regions are the places where the housing comes up to some relatively well-defined boundary, after which is the wildland. And then there's the intermix places, such as Paradise and other towns that are mixed in with the forest, mixed in with the wildland, where the houses are surrounded by the forest. In that kind of setting, it's extremely difficult to have any kind of buffer or break that would stop the fire from encroaching on it, because the houses are inside the forest. They're in the wildland. So we don't envision that we would be able to use this approach to help prevent another campfire that happened in Paradise. However, we do think that if you look at most of the fires that are affecting most of the population in California, these are interface fires, because there aren't that many cities that are built within the forest.
So you really are looking at a wall or a buffer, a barricade, as it were, that mm-hmm. on a clear line of demarcation between, or at least a relatively clear line of demarcation between the city and the wild.
That's right. And in most of the places that, you know, new developments have been built in California over the last several decades, there's a relatively clear line.
How wide would this need to be to really do any good?
That's one of the big questions we've been exploring. And this is one of those things where it's not a black or white thing. It's sort of a shades of gray. So as you make it bigger, you're going to have more benefit from it. And you would have to make it truly massive to stop the fire entirely. By truly massive, I mean, you know, probably 800 to 1,000 meters deep to completely stop the most extreme fires that we've seen in California. But the goal really for us, the way we look at it, is that we want to buy the firefighters enough time that they can stage a good defense of a neighborhood, rather than the fire spreading so fast as it has been the last several years that there's no hope of them defending a neighborhood. They just got to evacuate and get the people out of there. And so what we found is that with, you know, a couple hundred meters deep buffer, which is, you know, roughly the size of what you would imagine an orchard would be in a lot of these areas. So, you know, standard orchard sized depth banana buffers, we can significantly slow the fires. So we did, you know, simulations of this with some of the most extreme fire conditions. What we found is that even when the winds are blowing and the embers are being thrown, a couple hundred meters buys the firefighters several hours of time. And that's enough time for them to actually stage defense of a neighborhood. And the banana buffers also decrease the intensity of the fire simply because they're absorbing some of that heat and you know, they're being dried out by the fire that's progressing. And so that lower intensity makes it also safer for the firefighters to operate.
Now, I realize that this is something that you have modeled to some extent with a computer science, but it is very much conceptual at this point. I mean, nobody's out yet to try to plant trees and see if this works. This is something you're talking up, right?
Yeah. So, and I would say that that's the next step. So what we're planning and we're hoping to start up soon is plantings of exactly this. So planting out some with a collaborator of mine, Mikey Cantor at University of Hawaii, we're looking into planting out the bananas in Hawaii and then burning them and then measuring how effective were the banana buffers. One of the key things that we need to test here is which ground covers are effective in conjunction with the bananas. Because if you were to allow dry grass to grow underneath the bananas and you're irrigating them, but only partially irrigating them, then that could, you know, be just as bad as a wild hillside, because maybe the bananas don't burn, but the fire can spread right through. And so, you know, there have been instances, for example, in Australia, where there was a relatively small banana grove that was, I don't know the full circumstances, but in the midst of, you know, wildland, and the banana grove burned along with the wildland. And so, you know, we don't know what the ground cover was there. And it didn't seem clear to me that they had planned for it to be a non-flammable ground cover. So that's one of the things that we're going to be testing, which ground covers, say a succulent or some other low flammability ground cover, can go with the bananas. And then we also want to start looking at, can we diversify? So can we plant ginger along with the bananas, or, you know, some other crop species that can live in the sort of understory of the bananas?
So you realize that once you have in hand proof of concept, then this would represent, if people could buy into this, this would represent a major paradigm shift in agriculture in terms of a place like California. There'd have to be I can only imagine the battle of shifting public policy and the land usage issues. I mean, this is big.
It could be. I think what I would like to do with it is go sort of bottom up. And so, you know, find locations where there's a neighborhood or a city or, you know, a homeowners association or utility who has some land that they would like to try it on in Southern California, especially, and then work up from there. Or it could even be private landowners who want to protect some, you know, important structures. And so, you know, we can do pilot studies in that way. It doesn't have to be sort of a on high sort of policy that then changes the way we do it. And then, you know, if it proves to be effective, and not just effective in terms of fire prevention, but effective in terms of cost effective, because that's one of the key things here, that there are other ways that we can protect these neighborhoods. The difficulty is that they don't pay for themselves. And so that's one of the reasons we're not doing it today. And so if this can pay for itself and be effective in fire prevention, then that win-win hopefully will be apparent to policymakers who then maybe change their minds and make it more widely adopted.
And the paying for itself part, that just has to do with the sales of the fruit that would come from it.
That's right.
Can you think of other benefits for banana groves other than the fire prevention or mitigation, plus you get a crop of food off of it? Is there other aspects there that could either be monetized or at least be maybe an ecosystem, kind of a service, I think they call it, benefits beyond these two main ideas?
Yeah, so I think erosion control could be one important thing. You know, some of these areas, after they get hit by a fire, the soil tends to, you know, lead to runoff and erosion. And, you know, that problem becomes this cycle where you have a fire and then you have, you know, runoff and mudslides and things like that. And so it could help with that because bananas are evolved to do well in relatively shallow soils. They don't have deep, deep root systems like trees do, but they have very fibrous root systems in the first, you know, a couple feet of the soil. And so they'll help hold on to that loose soil post-fire.
So with a plant like the banana, will it behave after the top growth has been compromised by a fire? Will it behave the way some other trees will, where you'll see sprouting come up from the roots, new trees? Around here we have a scrub oak tree, and it can be burned clear down to the ground, and within maybe 2 or 3 years you'll see new shoots coming up.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so bananas will pop right back up. I mean, it depends on the intensity of the fire. Of course, you could kill the banana corm if it was intense enough of a fire, but
the corm is the part just right at the base of the tree under the ground.
That's right. Yeah. And so the thing is that the trunk itself, if it doesn't get damaged too much, even if the leaves burn off, and this happens also if it gets frost damage, for example, if it, you know, there are some cultivars that people have found will grow, you know, relatively far north in California. We don't know how far, we'd have to try it. But certainly in sort of the Central Valley, people have successfully fruited bananas where sometimes the leaves get damaged or even all get frost damaged. They die off over the winter. But then, you know, the first warm weather they get in the spring, those leaves start growing back from the trunk. And the stalk itself, the part we would sort of call the tree trunk of the banana, which is called the pseudostem, that survives typically on these sort of short frosts that we get in California, even in the areas that get frost. And so then it starts growing. And then those varieties, as long as the pseudostem was big enough before the winter, it will be able to fruit. Some of these varieties can fruit right away that same summer. Same thing has been attempted in Georgia. There's a short season cultivar that's been trialed in Georgia where they get also, you know, cold winters. But they have warm enough summers and long enough seasons that it can go from, not big enough to fruiting within that season that they have. And so the same thing is true for fire damage.
Dr. Bharath Raghavan is with us. We're talking about the potential of banana buffers in mitigating or preventing wildfires at the wildland urban interface. And I want to chat with him a little bit more about where he's coming from on all of this after a short break. In particular, I want to see how this fits in with some of his other philosophies about horticulture and sustainability and agroecology, for instance. That's coming up after a short break here on Constant Wonder. Stay with us. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. It's a great pleasure to have Dr. Bharath Raghavan with us. He is an assistant professor of computer science at the University of Southern California, and he is very interested in issues of sustainability, and he does computer modeling associated with sustainability. We've been talking about banana buffers. What do you do to combat the wildfire situation in a place like California? Bharath Raghavan, do you have any concerns that this solution will introduce another problem, and that being the problem of a less diversified kind of landscape? If you fill it with bananas, you're crowding out other stuff.
Yeah, so this is something I think quite a bit about. And what I'd say is that we only want to put this in places where we as humans have already disturbed the land in some sense. And if you think about a lot of these California hillsides that, you know, I'm speaking about, places where, you know, housing developments have encroached on those wildlands already, those are not and have not been, you know, quote unquote, native lands in the sense of the way that they're growing for hundreds of years. You know, there was the ranching era in California, which extended, you know, even until the 20th century, where a lot of these hillsides are now covered in introduced species. So, for example, there's a wild oat species that's from Europe that took over, and most in a lot of these areas is now the dominant sort of grass species that crowded out all the native California grasses. And so, you know, we've already gotten a different kind of monoculture that has taken over through these introduced species, almost by accident. You know, I don't think that it was, at least my limited understanding, it wasn't an intentional introduction during the ranching era. It just happened, you know, by accident somehow. And so, you know, we already have gotten that. We've already shaped the land in dramatic ways, and also, you know, fire districts and so on. And, you know, homeowners are expected to do things like mowing, and in some places, you know, utilities do herbicide spraying to keep vegetation growth low. So, you know, we're already shaping the land quite a bit. And so as long as we keep these banana buffers, not, you know, we don't put them way out in the truly wild lands, but we keep them right next to the neighborhoods that we're trying to protect, then, you know, we're shaping the land that we've already shaped, but in a more intelligent way is the way I see it. Now, there's this broader question of how do we think about diversifying the land, and, you know, where do we grow food, for example? And this kind of brings me to this other question of, you know, when we think about what a city is and, you know, what a neighborhood is, you know, we don't usually think about food being produced, at least in sort of an urban and suburban context. We don't usually think of it as being a place that we get our food from. And I've been trying to shift this perspective a little bit in my own way of looking at things and my research, and also my sort of hobbies, I guess you could say, in that I like to think of it as sort of life. Our life is in an agroecosystem. So the term agroecology is sort of a combination of agriculture and ecology. It's an ecological way of looking at an agricultural system. So all of the different components of an ecosystem and how they interplay in and happening to produce food for people. And so an agroecosystem is an agricultural ecosystem. And what if we thought about our lives in cities and suburban areas as being lived in an agroecosystem? How would that change the way that we see our yards and our parks and our, you know, the sidewalk strips on our streets? Because we have lots of ornamental trees in most cities, but we could grow, you know, fruit trees, for example, in these cities. And, you know, in a lot of cities, we would get yields off these fruit trees comparable to the fruit intake of the city itself. You know, we could probably grow, especially in Southern California, I know this to be the case, that we could grow vast quantities of food within the city itself instead of irrigating, you know, ornamental trees. And we would get the same benefits of ornamental trees. We'd get the green shade. We'd get the sort of the beauty of the trees as well, but get food at the same time.
Are you feeling like nowadays you're not quite such a lone voice in the wilderness on this issue? Because there are a lot of people talking like you talk about trying to take our living area right around our homes and our neighborhoods and somehow make that more serviceable in the production of food.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm late to this, if anything. You know, people have been talking about this kind of thing for decades, I think, and perhaps more and more so these days. And I'm really glad that people are looking at it this way. And part of it is that, you know, we've already shaped the land is the way I look at it. And so, you know, we've shaped the land to put down pavement and to build houses and build buildings. You know, why don't we try to provide some of our needs, our basic needs, such as food, from that same land so that we get multiple uses of it? And at the same time, that also allows us to decrease pressures on rural and wild land. We don't have to encroach on that wild land to build farms and to, you know, to expand farming to feed the population. If we can grow more of it in the areas that have already been turned into habitated and sort of urban land already.
So is the banana buffer concept kind of like a calling card for this greater cause of diversifying our landscapes within cities and suburbs?
I think it kind of came, it was maybe the other way around. I had already been looking into how do we grow food in the city context, both as a sort of a personal, you know, project and hobby, but also in my research and a broader research agenda I call computational agroecology, where we're trying to build systems that can, computing systems that can model how do we build an agroecosystem in a specific context. So you have a piece of land, it could be urban land, suburban land, wild, you know, rural land. And we want to say, given the climate of this land, given the topography of this land, given the objectives of the person involved, it could be a farmer, it could be a, you know, a homeowner, it could be a policymaker, given their objectives, how do we design an agroecosystem automatically that can say, well, you know, you should probably plant these different species and this is where they should be located and this is how they're going to interact. And then the person involved, who may not be an expert in agroecology, but they may know what they want out of the land, then they can give feedback to the system and say, well, this is actually what I'd like instead. You know, can you give me a design that's a little bit more like that? And so it's sort of an interactive, you know, computing tool to help with the design of these agroecosystems. So that's something that we're, you know, in the relatively early stages of building. This, the Banana Buffers project, is sort of philosophically aligned as a sort of an offshoot of that broader agenda.
Yeah. So how much of this, my final question for you, how much of this is just sheer fun and how much of it is problem solving for society at large?
Oh, I think both are one and the same, at least how I like to see it. It's that for a long time, I used to see my sort of technical work as being separate from this kind of broader societal impact. And, you know, I struggled to try and figure out, you know, my ostensible background in computing is in networking and applied security problems. So not really related to agroecology or sustainability or anything. And then I had my personal interests in that stuff. And what I recognized is that there's a need to bring these perspectives together because somebody's got to do it. And so I think it's both.
We've been talking about banana buffers as a concept for preventing and mitigating wildfires. And we've been visiting with Bharath Raghavan on this. He's a computer scientist at USC. He is also a member of the California Rare Fruit Growers Association. Very engaged, very enthusiastic about issues of sustainability and agroecology.
That was Marcus Smith. I'm Tenery Taylor. I guess if you had to choose between surrounding your house with water-filled banana trees and eucalyptus trees bursting with explosive oils, seems like a pretty obvious choice, especially if you lived in the hills around Oakland, California. Seems like every year we hear stories of California or other Western states burning fiercely. Are fires getting worse? We'll explore that question and some explanations when Constant Wonder returns in a moment.
I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. For several weeks this year, my young boy and I have wanted to fish in a vast lake nearby, which I just looked up, actually, online to learn about its surface area. It's 151 square miles of water, called Utah Lake. However, this lake has had a problem this year, as in recent years, a vast algal bloom. And so what does that mean? That means that fishing for us, while not entirely off limits, it just hasn't been very wise because of the toxins in the water. And so we've chosen to go fishing in other places, safer places. Well, the problem with the water in Utah Lake, from what I have read, is that unusually high levels of nutrients have made their way into the lake, and that leads to this explosive growth of the algae. And I suppose whenever we hear the word nutrients, we generally tend to think of that as having positive connotations, but maybe like too many supplemental vitamins, there could be too much of a good thing. And that has been the case with Utah Lake and countless other bodies of water around the country, around the planet for that matter. We are seeing way too many nutrients making their way into places that just can't handle that kind of input. Well, now the story here is sometimes attributed to the runoff from farmland. But in recent years, another culprit has entered the picture: runoff from formerly forested areas that have seen megafires. And so potentially we're talking here about a new kind of direct cause and effect. A fire devastates a region. The charred materials behind, they get covered with winter snow and rain, and then the spring runoff comes and carries it all down the drainages and the tributaries to a place like Utah Lake, and boom, bloom, and my boy and I can't go fishing. Well, as you probably already know if you've listened to our show, I'm very keen on exploring these kinds of relationships in the natural world. And I often find myself wondering what kind of a story we are really dealing with when something gets way out of whack. And by all accounts, if you hear about the frequency and the severity of recent wildfires, something here is out of alignment. To help paint this picture more scientifically than I ever could, I'm very pleased to have back again with us Dr. Ben Abbott. He's a professor of plant and wildlife sciences at Brigham Young University. He runs a lab at BYU studying how human activities do have an impact on water and nutrient cycles, and one of their current projects at the lab, from what I understand, is in fact the impact of these megafires in the western United States. He's on the line with us. Ben, welcome back to Constant Wonder.
Thank you so much, Marcus. I'm really happy to be here.
You know, just a moment ago here on our show, we were talking about the superabundance of CFCs in the atmosphere. We were talking about ozone. And now we're going to talk about maybe something that's kind of similar, kind of parallel, too much of something making its way into a system that just can't cope with it. Is it safe to say that this story is about too much of something and maybe that thing isn't all that bad?
That's exactly right, Marcus. These nutrients aren't toxic on their own. They're things that all life needs. The two most common nutrients are nitrogen and phosphorus. And most of you have probably seen that on a bag of fertilizer you get from the hardware store. That's the N and the P that's in the fertilizer you put in your garden. The problem is how much, and then also what time of year it ends up in these water bodies. That's what can really create these issues.
Well, I go way back in my memory to when I was a kid and we always had National Geographic magazines in our home. And I remember the Yellowstone fires and the cover and the pictures of those fires. And the story there was at first it was one of fear and tragedy and dismay and sorrow. And then as the years went on, the story became one of regeneration of you know, it was kind of a rejuvenating thing for parts of Yellowstone. And so somewhere in here, there's a story that could have a happy ending, maybe.
Absolutely. I think that in general, we tend to have a much too negative view of wildfires. Wildfires play a crucial role in these ecosystems. Humans tend to like things to stay the same. Right? We want to build houses and roads and walk along the same trails always. Nature, on the other hand, is constantly dynamic. It's constantly changing. And when we try to freeze nature in place, that actually can have some really negative consequences. So if you look back over the past couple hundred years in the western United States, we have suppressed wildfires. And even up to this day, we're running what's called a wildfire deficit. We're not having as many as we would without suppression of wildfires. That can cause all kinds of ecological problems, accumulation of excess material. It also can disadvantage some vegetation and animal species that are adapted to take advantage of those wildfires, things like aspen and a whole bunch of wildfires and grasses that won't survive in a fully developed mature forest. They need those openings when there is a wildfire.
Well, you're going to help me out with the idea of smoke getting in the air, because I always think of that as a bad thing. And if we've disrupted some of these cycles, you know, the pictures this last year out of San Francisco, of they were hellish pictures of the sky over the Golden Gate Bridge being more golden than the Golden Gate Bridge.
Yeah. And that's where the story really gets complicated. And it's important to remember. Had we all along been allowing wildfires to burn, that would be one thing. We haven't. We suppressed them for a long period of time. But over the past 50 years or so, our management of fires has vastly improved. And now what we're seeing is a large increase in the extent and severity of wildfires that's not associated with direct human management. It's being driven by climate change. Higher temperatures, drier fuels, and longer seasons when things are ready to burn. And so this it you can't just naively say wildfires are good or bad, because now we're seeing the fires in California, Oregon, more recently in Colorado, right? They've had the largest and the second largest wildfires in their history this year. And those are clearly associated with climate change. We have very careful scientific studies that have been done over the past few years that show that the majority of that increase in wildfire area and severity is attributable to human-caused climate change.
I would imagine it's very difficult to come up with any kind of an estimation about how much of this is to be pinned on us humans for the way we managed forests versus how much of this is to be pinned on us humans for the way we've pumped carbon into the atmosphere. But can it be measured? Can you really say, well, this is like 90% about climate change and only 10% about doing controlled burns? I don't even know how you could.
Yeah.
And I don't even know what the utility would be of demonstrating it that precisely.
You know, I think it's actually very important. We call that the science of attribution in climate change and environmental science. So what caused that event? And it's really pertinent, because if it's all about management, then we need to take certain actions to improve the way that the Forest Service and other land management groups are interacting with these ecosystems. But if it's climate change, we need to address that at its source, which is mainly the production of greenhouse gases. So Mike Flanagan is one of the leaders in attribution science. He's at University of Alberta, and he published a paper just this year about the California wildfires. And they came up with a number, and there's always an uncertainty range around that number. You know, it's going to be plus or minus 20 or 30%. But what they found was that 45% of the wildfires this year were directly attributable to climate change. And that matches other work that's come out over the past few years that shows that since 1985, when we first had these high-frequency, high-resolution wildfire measurements, there's been a doubling in the annual extent of area burned. And that doubling is attributable to climate change almost exclusively. That's after we've accounted for the changes in management over that period. And maybe more disturbing is the fact that the severe wildfires, the area of severe burn where you've consumed most of the organic matter in the soil and the material in the canopy, that has increased eightfold over the same time period. So we really are living in this unprecedented time of highly severe and very large wildfires.
So as long as we're talking attribution here, I think it might be good to even just talk about, is there a percentage of these that would have happened if there had been no humans present?
Absolutely. Wildfire occurs naturally. The mega fire that I believe you were referring to earlier here in Utah Valley that affected Utah Lake, that was started by a lightning strike. So the lightning strike, of course, wasn't caused directly by humans. What we did was we kind of set the scene by drying the fuels out, and then that wildfire burned all the way into October, a time period when usually here in Utah we're starting to get cooler temperatures and rain that's coming in. But that wasn't the case in 2018. So that's a pattern that we're seeing all over the place. Again, it's not that all wildfires are negative. They're a crucial part of the ecosystem. But if they're happening at the wrong times, and if they're too severe and large, then they can be very destructive, not only to humans, the air that we breathe, but also to the organisms in the ecosystems.
Now, I don't know how many times I've already used the word megafire, but sometimes, you know, mega mega just gets tossed out there sometimes as a superlative. But I think there's something else going on here. Has somebody actually defined what qualifies as a megafire and what's just a forest fire?
Yeah, so mega is defined typically based on two factors: the size, over 100,000 hectares, and the severity. It has to be moderate or severe severity. And so there also can be gigafires. So thinking about the storage in your computer, you've got a megabyte and then a gigabyte, a thousandfold larger than that. And so we now saw this year the very first gigafires, when a few of those very large fires in Northern California merged and created a gigafire.
So you go mega, then giga, then apaca fire.
Yeah. Or is it Terra after Giga?
I'm not sure. Yeah.
My prefix is in order. But it does have a formal definition. But for me, there's nothing magical that happens right when it goes over that threshold. What's different is just how large and how severe these wildfires are.
Now, I know that you have a lot to do with the study of just the cycles of water. So are you actually tracing what gets washed away from off of, say, a mountainside down into a stream?
Yeah, just like you said, my specialty is mainly on the aquatic side. So the streams, the groundwater, the lakes that are receiving water from these different environments. And what's really interesting about a wildfire is because it removes so much vegetation, that vegetation typically takes water up from the soil and returns it to the atmosphere. Once that's gone, a lot more water, at least in the first year after the wildfire, typically runs off. And with that water comes a huge amount of sediment and nutrients. Those nutrients also would have been greedily taken up by the plants that were growing. You know, they are nutrient limited. It's not like a plant in your garden where they have as much nutrient as they could want. They are trying to scour every molecule of nitrogen and phosphorus from that soil. So once they get taken out of the picture, that nitrogen and phosphorus can be leached out of the soil into the water. And so that's what we've seen in the year or two, up to 5 years after the wildfire. We see these releases of nutrients and then other materials that come out of the wildfire.
Is this going to differ from region to region? I mean, I'm thinking about a sagebrush area in the Intermountain West versus a redwood fire in Northern California and the way the roots are trying to capture nutrients. I would imagine that the scarcity or the abundance of nutrients is, you got deserts and you have more fertile areas, right?
Absolutely. You've touched on a really important thing, that the type of ecosystem is going to determine what the response is, and also the severity of the wildfire. So in those sagebrush ecosystems, sagebrush is a really neat fire-adapted species. It can survive moderate severity fires really well, but these high severity fires can kill the sagebrush. And you can imagine, if the plants are still there the year after the wildfire, they're going to hold the soil in place. They're going to retain some of those nutrients. So the wildfire might not have much of an effect on water quality. But if you have a high severity wildfire, especially if that affects a large area, then not only can you have release of nutrients, you also can have these massive landslides and debris flows that happen afterwards. So the type of ecosystem matters, and also how severe is the fire.
When you say severe, you're talking about how hot it gets for how long, or what are you talking about exactly?
There are two ways that severity is measured, and one of them is that exactly. How hot did the flame actually get? But the ecosystem way of measuring fire severity is what percentage of the material, the burnable material, was consumed. So if you've ever walked by a wildfire, sometimes it looks like a moonscape. Anything that was alive is gone. It's been vaporized, combusted. Other times, there still are tree trunks that are there, sometimes living plants. You still can have organic material in the soil. So that's going to be how we determine what the severity of the wildfire was for a particular area.
So I am by nature somebody who is given to a little bit of pessimism, I would have to say. And so when I see a mega fire and I see a story of something out of California, I mean, I was thinking just the other day, I ought to take my kids on a little hike out to one of these areas that's been burned here locally, just so we can kind of see it and talk about it. And I think that would be instructive and educational, and I'm not sure that they're going to like it very much because it might look a little like a moonscape. But what would I be looking for, just as somebody who's not a scientist, and I'm wondering, will that sagebrush return or will that oak tree come back?
Yeah, there's some really important factors that determine what is the trajectory, what's the pathway of ecosystem recovery. In ecology, we call that succession. It's the stages that an ecosystem follows after some big disturbance. And it's really important what kind of seeds are left over. A very severe wildfire might burn down into the soil and destroy some of the seed bank. Those are the seeds that may have been there for sometimes hundreds or even thousands of years, waiting for the conditions to be right to germinate. If, however, there are native seeds left over in that area, very quickly you see some of these plants germinate and take advantage of that burst of nutrients and light that comes after the wildfire. But that also highlights one of the risks that we're seeing more and more. When we travel to places, very often we transport seeds unknowingly. They're stuck in our socks or the bottoms of our shoes. And sometimes we transport seeds that are not native. And there are certain non-native plants that can take advantage of those conditions really well. So here in the western United States, there's a species of grass called cheatgrass that spreads very, very easily. It grows very quickly. And if that takes over an area that was burned, that can be really damaging. And the ecosystem doesn't recover to what it was before. It could transition into to something new that doesn't have the biodiversity that, that it used to have.
So if an area has been burned, whether it's here in Utah or in Oregon or Washington or California, wherever it is, Colorado we've been talking about too, is our understanding of the succession of an ecosystem, are we far enough along that we kind of know what we could properly introduce if seeds could be brought in?
That's a great question. I actually would say that it still is an open question. Ecosystems are incredibly complex. They don't just involve the species that are there, but also the conditions that follow, the weather conditions, the soil conditions. And so a lot of it depends on what happens in the few years after that wildfire. And so we used to think 50 and 100 years ago that ecosystems followed this really orderly progression and that we'd be able to predict what would happen based on those initial conditions. Now we're much more humble intellectually as ecologists, and we recognize that it depends a lot on what the local conditions are. That said, there are certain actions that very often are taken. Native seeds often are redistributed to prevent soil erosion. And then sometimes people are asked to stay out of burned areas because they can be sensitive during that year or two after the wildfire occurs. So I'd encourage you to get informed and contact the local land managers or owners and get an idea of what they are trying to do to mitigate the effects of that wildfire.
Marcus Smith there speaking with Ben Abbott, a professor of plant and wildlife sciences at Brigham Young University. Have you ever considered the improbability of the peacock? Even if the primary reason for all that plumage is to attract a mate, doesn't it seem a little overdone? Why are they so stunning? And what can we learn from them? Constant Wonder will be right back with some answers after the news.